This is the February edition of Ask, Science and Exploration for Curious Kids. I'm Chris Radio volunteer Ron Pariser. The front cover of the magazine shows a dog howling, and he's thinking about a wolf howling. The title, Wolf to Woof. Page 2, Nosy News, by Nosy Newsies. Ahoy again! In the old days, ships traveled the seas using big sails to catch the wind. Sailing by wind took skill and luck, and ships sometimes had to sit and wait for a breeze. So when engines were invented in the 1800s, ships ditched sails for more reliable steam power. But now, sails are making a comeback on big ships. Shipping companies have discovered that getting a boost from free wind can be a great way to save money on fuel and reduce pollution. Modern sails don't look like the old-fashioned kind. Some are metal and fold up into tall columns. Some fly like kites to pull the ship along. These ships still have engines, but put the sails out when the wind is right. Engineers are testing different designs to see which are the most efficient, and soon cargo ships may sail the seas again. In the photograph, the ship Pyxis Ocean is testing out new metal sails. In the cartoon, Plush Potum says, "Let's keep our asteroids tidy." Dusty delivery. The OSIRIS-REx probe flew around the asteroid Bennu and looked for a good place to sample. In September, after a 7-year wait, NASA got a very exciting delivery. Dust, fresh from an asteroid. The cupful of space dust is the prize of a mission called OSIRIS-REx. In 2016, the robot probe set out for a small asteroid called Bennu, which circles the sun between Earth and Mars. It took 2 years to get to the asteroid, and the probe spent another 2 years studying it. Then it touched down and scooped up a sample. Finally, as planned, the probe dropped off the sample pod as it sped past Earth. The canister landed safely in Utah, and now scientists are studying its dusty contents. Why all the interest? Asteroids, like Bennu, formed at the same time as the planets, around 4 billion years ago. But unlike rocks on Earth, asteroids have not changed much since then. So asteroid rock is like getting a peek at the early Earth. The first tests on the space dust reveal lots of water and carbon molecules, the basic ingredients of life. There are two photographs at the bottom of page 3. The small dust sample container separated from the probe and dropped down in the Utah desert. It was so full of dust that some leaked out the top. Hide the treats. Dogs have an amazing sense of smell, which lets them track animals, people, and stinky socks just about anywhere. But smell is not the only sense they use to find snacks. A new study suggests that dogs and wolves can get a head start by remembering where food might be. In this study, researchers hid dog treats around a field and timed how long it took dogs to find them all. They ran the same tests with wild wolves. Sometimes they hid the treats when the animal wasn't looking. Other times they let the animals watch. Both dogs and wolves found the hidden treats more quickly when they saw them being hidden. This suggests that canines can remember where another animal has hidden food. Wolves did slightly better than dogs on these tests, but researchers think this is probably just because wolves are more strongly interested in food. Some birds and squirrels also have this skill, which they use to steal stashed food from one another. Bot says, "That's why I hide my snacks in cyberspace." I'm going to skip Nestor's dock and turn to page 6. Tale of the Dog by Ellen R. Braff. Art by Amanda Shepherd. Tiny Teacup Poodles, Massive Newfoundlands, Squat Bulldogs, Sleek Greyhounds, Mexican Hairless Dogs, Bearded Collies. Dogs come in an amazing variety of sizes, shapes, personalities, and talents. Where did they all come from? And how did they get to be our best pals? At the site of one of the earliest human settlements in northern Israel, archaeologists found the skeleton of a woman buried 12,000 years ago. The remains of a puppy seemed to be cradled in her hands. Not far away, scientists discovered a man from around the same time, buried with two dog-like animals. Dog fossils have been found in China, Germany, Italy, Russia, and Iraq, dating back at least 14,000 years. And some scientists who study the origins of the dog by looking at its DNA, cell codes, think that dogs might go back much further, perhaps 135,000 years. One thing we know for sure, dogs are our oldest animal friends. Before horses, cows, pigs, goats, sheep, and way before cats, which first became pets in Egypt about 5,500 years ago, dogs were part of human history. Grandpa Wolf. So, where did dogs come from? We know part of the answer. Dr. Jennifer Leonard, a biologist at Uppsala University, says that recent DNA studies leave no doubt that dogs evolved from wolves. Scientists have even narrowed down the dog's grandpaws to a single species, the gray wolf. More amazing still, it now looks like most modern-day dogs can trace their roots back to just a few female wolves that once lived in East Asia, probably China. Over time, the descendants of these wolves spread throughout the world. When early humans first came to North America from Asia, crossing the Bering Sea land bridge to Alaska sometime before 9000 BCE, they brought their dogs with them. But while scientists agree that wolves evolved into dogs, just how did such an amazing transformation take place? How could a wild wolf become a tame dog? The key is in wolves' relationship to humans. At the bottom of pages 6 and 7, there are pictures of a variety of dogs. The first one is thinking, "You used to be a wolf?" Zias says, "Are you sure this one was a wolf?" And Avery says, "Not him, his ancestors long ago." There's a picture. The caption reads, "Ancient Egyptians sometimes mummified dogs. This dog mummy represents Anubis, the Egyptian god of burials. He guided the souls of the dead to the afterlife." The Wanderers. During the last ice age, about 60,000 to 12,000 years ago, ancient humans and wolves had much in common. Both lived in groups and hunted animals for food. They lived in the same areas and competed for the same prey. Wolves lived in well-organized family groups called packs. Each pack member, from the leader, or alpha wolf, to the youngest pup, has a rank and a role in the group. Group needs come first. Pack members work together to hunt for food and raise the young. They follow the leader and respect each other's rank, and they are affectionate to one another. Wolves are smart, too. Bringing down large prey requires intelligence and cooperation. To survive, the pack must communicate and learn. Wolves use a complex language of movements, gestures, and sounds to share information and let other pack members know what they are doing. Away from the pack, wolves are shy. Like other wild animals, they fear strangers and act with caution in unfamiliar situations. But scientists think that some ancient wolves may have been a bit bolder and more curious about humans. Maybe these bolder wolves learned there were advantages to hanging around the two-legged hunters. Stealing food from the humans was probably easy. And who doesn't like a free lunch? Or maybe it was the humans who followed the wolves around, hoping for a share of the kill. Perhaps people were curious about wolves, wondering whether these intelligent and skilled four-legged hunters could be of some use. Biologists believe that after a long time of living as neighbors, a few wolves grew less fearful and less wild. Some of these friendlier wolves may have moved from place to place with our nomadic ancestors, not on a leash, but free to come and go as they pleased. Our ancestors may have occasionally adopted orphaned wolf pups or even stolen pups from their dens. Then they reared these pups by hand and tamed them, choosing the gentlest and most obedient to serve as hunting companions and pets. At the top of page 8, there's a photograph. The caption reads, "Like people, wolves live in social groups and have signals for getting along well. Each wolf plays a role in helping the pack survive." Bot says, "Skip the body language. I prefer email." In another photograph of wolves, the caption reads, "Many traits that we like in dogs, such as being playful and not aggressive, are more typical of young wolves than of adults. Some scientists compare domesticated dogs to wolf puppies that never grow up." In the photograph, the young wolf is thinking, "I want to stay cute forever." Plushpotum says, "I'm the leader of the pack." Meet the family. Modern dogs and wolves belong to an animal family called canids. This family of dog cousins includes foxes, coyotes, jackals, and wild dogs, as well as wolves. There are photographs of a dog, wolf, African wild dog, fox, coyote, and jackal. Friendly foxes. Could the friendly dogs we know and love really have come from fierce wild wolves? In 1959, Russian scientist Dmitry Belyav began an experiment to test whether a tame animal might be bred from a wild one, and how long it would take. He worked with silver foxes, a cousin of dogs. For 26 years, Belyav mated foxes that were the friendliest and least afraid of people. Gradually, Belyav created a group of foxes that acted more like pet dogs than wild foxes. To his surprise, they also started to look more like dogs, with curly tails, droopy ears, and different coat colors. Similar body changes are also seen in some other domestic animals, like cows and pigs. There are 3 photographs of these foxes. The first is labeled "not too friendly." The second, "I guess you can pet me," and the third, "new human bestie." There's a photograph of a wild fox next to a domesticated fox. It's pointed out the floppy ears, smaller jaw, piebald coat, shorter legs, and curly tail. Bot says, "I'm the most modern breed of all." Page 10. Who let the dogs in? Marvin is sitting with Plushpotum and Zia and says, "I think I'm going to hang around here and act friendly." Most scientists believe that these less scared wolves started to evolve into dogs about 12,000 years ago. Around that time, Earth began to warm a bit, and the glaciers that covered a lot of the land started to retreat. Some humans gave up their wandering ways to settle down in permanent villages. Again, it was food that may have brought humans and wolves closer together. Like modern city dwellers, ancient humans produced a lot of garbage. For the wolves, human trash heaps were a kind of all-you-can-eat buffet. It was the village dump that really split the wolf family in two, says Professor Ray Coppinger. He believes that the wolves that eventually evolved into dogs were the ones that started hanging around human garbage dumps on a permanent basis. it was these roving disposal squads that villagers tamed and bred to become dogs. There's a photograph at the bottom of page 10, and the caption reads, "Beware of dog, cave canum in Latin, is an ancient Roman expression. Roman dogs guarded homes, and a farmer returning from market might put his money in a bag around his dog's neck to keep it safe from bandits. But the puppy in this tile mosaic from Pompeii looks pretty friendly. Curly tails and floppy ears. Domestication, the process by which animals are changed to suit humans, takes a long time. Humans gradually domesticated wolves through selective breeding. When our ancestors found a wolf whose behavior or looks they liked, they kept it and mated it with another wolf that had the same desirable features. With luck, pups would be born with their parents' good qualities." According to animal behaviorist Ann Squire, the first thing people looked for when they began to domesticate the wolf was an animal that was willing to accept a person as top dog, or alpha wolf. A wolf that refused to share its catch with humans wouldn't be much help as a hunter. She also says that for the same reasons, our early ancestors probably chose to breed wolves that appeared less threatening, those that were smaller in size and had smaller teeth. After many generations, these domesticated wolves started to look very different from their wild cousins. Compared to their wild wolf ancestors, these dogs had smaller skulls, brains, and teeth. The process of domestication also brought about other physical changes. Tails curled, ears flopped, coats changed colors, and domesticated dogs, unlike adult wolves, barked. Most important, domesticated dogs behaved differently from the wolf, enabling dogs to thrive in human society and serve as useful companions. Dogs with jobs. Once people learned how to selectively breed dogs, we began to create canines that came in different sizes and shapes to do many jobs. Hunting was an important job, and dogs were bred to specialize in different hunting tasks. Tracking prey through dense forests required animals with a keen sense of smell. Bred for the ability to follow a scent trail, a bloodhound's tracking still is legendary. But in open country, where humans hunted fleet-footed prey, fast dogs with good eyes were needed. Greyhounds and Afghan hounds are descendants of dogs bred for this purpose. Terriers were bred to go after rats on villages and farms. The photograph at the top of page 11 is captioned, "Collies have a strong herding instinct and are smart enough to learn complicated commands, perfect for their job of tending sheep." The photograph at the bottom of page 11, "Shepherds needed big, brave dogs to guard their sheep against wild animals. The white coat of this commandeer makes it hard for a creeping wolf to tell it apart from the sheep." Plushpottom says, "My job is to keep order around here." When sheep and goats were domesticated about 10,000 years ago, dogs helped guard and herd them. To protect their sheep, farmers needed dogs that were bigger and fiercer than wolves. They bred dogs called mastiffs, weighing as much as 200 pounds, 90 kilograms. To herd livestock, farmers looked for dogs that showed some, but not all, of a wolf's hunting instincts. When wolves hunt, they round up herds of animals, then separate the weak or ill so they can attack them. Farmers needed animals that would round up but not attack their flock. Collies and Shetland sheepdogs are examples of dogs originally bred for this purpose. Just friends. Today, specially trained dogs, such as guide dogs for the blind and hearing dogs for the deaf, help people in many important ways. This is shown on the photograph on page 13. But most modern dogs don't have a job. They're not hunters or herders or guard dogs. They're just friends. Unlike their wolf ancestors, modern dogs could not survive on their own in the wild. But all dogs are still part wolf on the inside, even if they look like chihuahuas or beagles or collies on the outside. Their human family is their pack. They depend on us for food, shelter, and companionship, and they look to us as leaders of the pack, whether purebreds or mutts. Working dogs or pampered pets. Today's dogs have traveled a long way since their ancestors parted paths with the wolf. Somewhere on that journey, they left their paw prints on our hearts. Plush Potom is hugging Zia and says, "You've left your hoof prints on my heart." Turn back to page 12. Clued into humans. Another trait that may have helped dogs adapt to human society is their ability to read human cues. Brian Hare, a biological anthropologist, did a simple experiment to see if dogs are better than wolves or chimpanzees at understanding human signals and hints to find food. How the experiment worked. Before testing the animals, Hare and his team members placed food in one of two covered containers. The test animals could not smell or see the food. They had to choose the correct container based only on their understanding of different human clues. There are photographs of the chimpanzees and dogs retrieving the food. Before allowing the animals to choose, experimenters either looked at, pointed to, tapped, or placed a marker on the container with food. Would the animal take the hint and pick the right jar? Neither the brainy chimps nor the crafty wolves did well on these tests. Even wolves that were raised by humans did not. However, domesticated puppies, even ones who did not spend much time with humans, readily followed human hints to the snack. The chimp can't find the food, but it's no problem for the dog, as shown in the photographs. The researchers concluded that the dog's ability to read human clues is not learned from people or inherited from wolves. When Hare traveled to Siberia and gave the same tests to Believ's foxes, he found that the tame foxes read human cues as well as dogs can. This suggests that breeding animals for tameness may also select for social smarts. There is a photograph of Brian Hare and his consultant, Milo. Bot says, "I can read, you know," while Avery holds a clipboard and is pointing to doggy bones. Page 14. What makes dogs tick? Fur. A furry coat keeps the dog warm. Some dogs have two kinds of fur, a woolly undercoat and a long outer layer. Tail. Dogs use their tails for balance and to let other dogs and us know how they're feeling. Happy with the tail in the air, scared with the tail down between its legs. Play bow. When a dog bends down its front legs with its tail wagging in the air, it's an invitation to play and means, "Let's be friends." A small bow can also say, "Okay, you're the boss," to other dogs. Feet. Dogs walk on their toes. Tough pads protect the bottoms of the feet. Thick toenails help grip the ground and are useful for digging. Ears. Dogs have sharp hearing and can move their ears in different directions to locate sounds. They can hear high-pitched sounds that we can't. Eyes. Dogs don't see as many colors as we do. To a dog, red and green look the same, but they are much better at spotting motion and can see more to either side of their body. Tongue. Dogs don't sweat like we do. To cool off, they pant. Water evaporates off their long tongues to cool them down. Dog tongues don't have many taste buds, so food might all taste the same to them. Super smeller. Dogs are famous for their fantastic sense of smell. Their noses are packed with smell sensors, and their brains have a large area devoted to scents. Smell is a dog's most important sense. With a quick sniff, a dog can tell who you are, where you've been, if you're sick, and what you had for lunch yesterday. Whiskers. Sensitive hairs around the nose and mouth help the dog feel objects and sense small movements. Muzzle. A dog's muzzle is the nose and mouth. Some are long and narrow, and some are very short. Marvin watches while Rasputin has a wrench, and Bot says, "Don't even think about it." Sure, your dog can fetch a frisbee, but would she save you from a charging buffalo? Read on for a few tales, some true, some maybe tall, of famous canine heroes and villains. Good Dog, Bad Dog, by Rachel Young, art by Thor Wickstrom. Togo saves Nome. In January 1925, people in the town of Nome, Alaska, were sick with a serious illness called diphtheria. There was a medicine that could treat it, but Nome didn't have any. So sled dog team set out to get the medicine from another town, 674 miles, or 185 kilometers, away. They set up a relay, each team passing the medicine on to the next to get it there faster. A dog named Balto became famous for leading the team on the last leg into Nome. But another dog, Togo, led the team that ran the longest stretch, 260 miles, or 420 kilometers. Thanks to all the dogs, the serum reached Nome in time to save the town. Seaman saves Lewis. When Meriwether Lewis and William Clark set out to explore the American West in 1804, they brought along Lewis's Newfoundland dog, Seaman. One night, an enormous buffalo blundered into the campground. As the panicked animal raced toward the tent where the explorers were sleeping, Seaman flung himself in the buffalo's path and chased it away. Forever grateful, Lewis named a stream in Montana Seaman's Creek in honor of his brave dog. Barry saves lost travelers. Born in 1800, Barry, the Saint Bernard, saved more than 40 people lost in the snowy Swiss Alps. According to legend, he once found a boy at the edge of an icy cliff that no human could reach. Barry carefully woke the freezing child by licking his face. Then the boy threw his arms around Barry's neck, and the big dog carried him to safety. Today, St. Bernards are still bred at the Mountain Monastery where Barry worked, and at least one dog is always named Barry. Urian bites Pope. In 1530, Henry VIII, the King of England, wanted a divorce, but the Pope said no way. So Henry sent Cardinal Wolsey to Rome to change the Pope's mind. As was the custom, the Cardinal bent down to kiss the Pope's toe. But Wolsey's greyhound, Urian, thought the Pope was trying to kick his master. The faithful dog lunged forward and bit the Pope's foot. The Pope was hopping mad and refused to grant Henry's request. Dog burns Newton's homework? In the 1600s, scientist Isaac Newton was hard at work on a book that would finally explain gravity. Then, calamity. One day when he was out, a fire started in his study and burnt his papers. Newton was so upset that it was a whole year before he could bring himself to write out the work again. What caused the fire? No one knows. Many years after Newton's death, a book about Newton's life said the fire started when Newton's pet dog overturned a candle. But Newton never mentioned having a dog, and most historians doubt that the story is true. It was an old excuse even then. Moritz can't sleep. One of the most famous pilots of World War I was Manfred von Richthofen, nicknamed the Red Baron. His pet Great Dane called Moritz slept on the Baron's bed every night. On April 20, 1918, the restless dog kept the Baron awake all night. The very next day, enemy aircraft shot down the Baron's plane. Coincidence, or was the Baron too sleepy to fly well? Page 18. My hero. How Some Little Penguins Got a Big New Best Friend by Nick Gill. In the photograph, Yudi, a fluffy Maremma, nuzzles a fluffy penguin chick in her care. You may have heard of dogs protecting houses, people, or a flock of sheep. But what about a big fluffy dog that protects little fluffy penguins? Little birds under attack. Middle Island, just off the coast of Warrnambool in southeastern Australia, has long been a home to a colony of little blue fairy penguins. Unless you're a fish, fairy penguins are gentle creatures. They are the world's smallest penguin. They spend about half the year at sea. Adult birds waddle back onto solid ground in late winter or spring to breed and raise their chicks in shallow burrows along the coasts of Australia and New Zealand. There's a photograph of the fairy penguins. Though they are great swimmers, their scientific name, Eudiptula minor, means good little diver. On shore, fairy penguins are comically clumsy. In the 1900s, foxes were brought to Australia by Europeans. Since then, they have preyed on small native animals across the country. In some places, they've pushed species into extinction. For many animals and birds, islands are the only refuges left from this formidable predator. For years, Middle Island was considered a safe haven for breeding birds, but then disaster struck. In 2005, the island was home to 600 fairy penguins, but over one terrible week, the population was almost completely wiped out. At low tide, a few foxes swam across the narrow channel from the mainland and embarked on a killing spree that left only four adult birds alive. An oddball solution. The local community was appalled. Everyone was upset, but no one knew what to do. Then Swampy Marsh, a local chicken farmer, stepped forward. He had a dog, he said, that guarded his chickens. Perhaps she could guard the penguins, too. That dog was named Oddball. Oddball was a Maremma, a type of dog bred in Italy to guard sheep from wolves. These dogs bond with the sheep, becoming part of their flock. Maremmas even look like sheep. They are large, fluffy, and light-colored, with soft brown eyes and quiet manners. But these quiet giants are fiercely protective if they feel that their adopted families may be under threat. Maremmas protect their woolly families by challenging predators and chasing them away, and also just by being there. Maremmas mark their territories with pee and poop. Just picking up on the large dog's scent often makes smaller predators, like foxes, steer clear. Penguin is talking to Bot, and Bot says, "A fox-free island? Have you tried Antarctica?" There's a photograph. The caption reads, "Island guardians on duty. No foxes allowed." Zia says, "Those foxes should stay on their own island." On page 20, the photograph reads, "Puppies start out living with chickens, so they get used to bird behavior. They learn to protect all kinds of birds." Marvin says, "Think we can get Plush to follow it around instead?" The Maremma's caring nature has been a boon for free-range poultry farmers. The dogs look after chickens and turkeys in open yards. Swampy's dog had protected his chickens for many years. If his Maremmas could bond with regular chickens, surely he could also teach them to protect chooks in dinner suits, Australian slang for chickens in tuxedos or penguins. Swampy's plan sounded a bit crazy, but the community was desperate. If they didn't do something fast, there might be no penguins left at all. Swampy was given the go-ahead to bring Oddball onto the island. Everyone held their breath. Would it work, or was this the end for Middle Island's fairy penguins? Penguin shepherds saved the day. It worked like a charm. The Maremmas were happy to chase away foxes from the strange-looking tiny blue birds. Cut to 2023, and the little penguins are going strong. Surveys show a steady rise in bird numbers. Since Oddball first stepped onto the island, more Maremmas have joined the team. A training program on the mainland teaches new dogs to be penguin protectors. No humans are allowed on Middle Island itself to give the penguins some space, but the dogs get daily visits from their handler, who feeds and plays with them while their feathery friends are at sea. The dogs themselves have become famous. They've appeared on international TV shows, and their story was made into a film called Oddball. They've also inspired conservation teams elsewhere to harness the power of dogs to protect other threatened animals. All in a day's work for some very good dogs. There is a photograph, a pair of fairy penguins in a nest box. And another photograph captioned, the current team of guardian dogs, Mezzo, Oberon, and Isola, with their trainer. The dogs patrol the paths onto the island, but don't go onto the island itself. Bot, Elvis, and Avery cheer, our heroes. Zia says, I'm going to Australia to be a dog. Going back to the top of page 20, dogs helping wildlife. Marembas are not the only dogs helping to protect wildlife around the world. Dogs are great at following scent trails. That makes them useful for finding rare animals in dense forests, or the animal's poop, so that researchers can count them and get DNA samples. Some dogs are trained to sniff out whale poop on the ocean. They guide research boats to the poop, which helps scientists check on the health of the whales. Many dogs work as sniffers in airports and border crossings, as noted in the photograph. They can smell hidden plants and wild animals that people might be trying to smuggle illegally. A dog's super sense of smell can detect even the smallest whiff of a hidden bird, plant, or bug. Page 22. Dog Bully by Shannon Wheeler. Time for school. We don't want to walk to school. There's a big scary dog. Are you afraid of the dog? No. Maybe. Don't be afraid. He's behind a fence. Bark, bark, bark. You're safe. He can't hurt you. Bark, bark, bark. You can't get us. Stupid dog. Bark, bark, bark. Just because the dog can't hurt you doesn't mean you can be jerks. The dog hates us, so we hate him. Does teasing the dog make things better? No. Bark, bark. What if we give him treats? He's happy. He likes us. Can we let him out? No. Page 24. The Return of the Wolves by Tracy von der Brink. Does wilderness need wolves? There are photographs of wolves. The year is 1995. At the edge of a wire enclosure on a wooded slope in Yellowstone National Park, a gray wolf raises her shaggy head and pricks up her ears. She lifts her muzzle to the sky, closes her golden eyes, and sings out a howl. Nearby, one of her new pack replies, "Ahoo!" It's a sound that hasn't been heard in Yellowstone for 70 years, but now the wolves are back. The War on Wolves. Gray wolves once roamed throughout North America. That changed when European settlers pushed west in the 1800s. Farmers cut down forests and plowed prairies, removing the habitats where wolves and their prey lived. Ranchers killed wolves to keep them from hunting sheep and cattle. When Yellowstone National Park was founded in 1872, there were only a handful of wolves on park lands. Back then, people did not think about how animals worked together in an ecosystem. Park officials were afraid that the wolves would hunt too many Yellowstone animals, so the wolves were shot and poisoned. In 1926, the last gray wolf pack in Yellowstone was destroyed. By the 1970s, wolves were almost gone from the whole U.S. In 1973, gray wolves were listed as an endangered species. That meant that national parks had a duty to help wolves survive. At the same time, scientists were beginning to think about how ecosystems work. They studied how all the plants, animals, and insects depend on each other. They realized that ecosystems need natural predators to be healthy. Avery says to Ratsputin, "A healthy ecosystem is a balancing act." This could be seen in Yellowstone. With no wolves, elk and deer had taken over. Huge herds ate all the young plants and trees. That meant fewer trees for birds and beavers. Hillsides nibbled bare caused mudslides and fouled rivers. The park had even started killing elk to keep the population down. But maybe there was a more natural solution. Perhaps helping the wolves would also help the park. In 1983, Yellowstone was chosen to be a wolf recovery area. Some people who lived around the park weren't happy with the idea. Ranchers were afraid wolves would leave the park and eat their cows. Hunters didn't want wolves killing game that the hunters wanted to shoot themselves. Some people were just afraid of wolves. But after 10 years of study and planning, the wolf recovery program was ready to begin. There's an illustration at the top of page 26. Three species of canids live in Yellowstone: wolves, smaller coyotes, and the smallest red foxes. Coyotes chase foxes, and wolves chase coyotes. New hope. In 1995, wildlife biologists captured 14 wolves in Canada and brought them to Yellowstone. Wolves live in close family groups, so they tried to capture related pairs. The biologists chose wolves that had been seen hunting elk, game that they would find in Yellowstone. At first, the wolves were kept in a penned area together so they could get used to their new home and form new packs. Park rangers kept out of sight so the naturally shy wolves would not get used to humans. But they did put radio collars on the wolves to keep an eye on them. Once the scientists were sure the wolves were healthy and could survive on their own, they released the wolves into the park. From 1995 to 1996, 31 Canadian gray wolves were moved to Yellowstone, and 10 more were brought from Montana. Yellowstone Park biologists watched the wolves closely. In one case, a pack scattered and wandered into ranchers' lands. The wolves were captured and brought back. One wolf killed 50 sheep and had to be destroyed, and the rancher was paid for his lost sheep. But mostly, the wolves stayed in Yellowstone. With so many elk and deer to hunt, why would they leave? They had pups and formed new packs. These days, around 100 wolves are usually living in Yellowstone, in about 10 packs. That number is not set by the park rangers. It's just the natural number of wolves that the ecosystem can support. At the bottom of page 26, there's a photograph, and the caption reads, "How to spy on wolves. Wolves are shy animals. They run fast and live in the most remote parts of Yellowstone. So how do biologists keep track of them? With a little help from tech. The first tool is radio collars. These are like dog collars with a small box attached. The box sends radio signals that lets rangers track the location of the wolf and other things like temperature. The collars are fitted to each wolf. The wolves themselves don't seem to notice them, although sometimes young wolves will chew on them just out of curiosity. Biologists try to collar at least one wolf in each pack so they can keep track of the group. They also keep an eye on the wolves with remote cameras and sometimes with drones. A drone can fly fast enough to follow a pack as they hunt. These tools have helped biologists learn more about how wild wolves live." Marvin says, I can think of another use for these. And his sign says, plush tracker. Another photograph at the bottom of the page. Magpies, ravens, and eagles share scraps from wolf kills. On page 26, there are two photographs. The first caption reads, a wolf pack stops for a break. And the second, these are some of the first Canadian wolves brought to Yellowstone. They were kept in pens for a while to get used to their new home. Elvis says, I think I'll stick with mangoes. Gifts of the wolves. Scientists were pretty sure bringing back gray wolves would be good for the park, but even they have been surprised by just how much wolves have helped. Before the wolves returned, 20 to 30,000 elk had overrun the park, eating young trees and trampling the ground. The wolves ate some elk, but the biggest change was that they chased the herds, and elk avoided areas where the wolves were. That gave willow and aspen trees a chance to grow, and that helped beavers, which need trees for food and dams. Before the wolves came, there was one beaver colony. Now there are nine. More beavers made more dams, which created pools of cool, shady water for fish and new wetland habitats for ducks, otters, and frogs. Fewer elk eating bushes meant more berries for birds and black bears. Grizzly bears also feed on wolf kills. Sometimes they chase wolves away from their own dinners. So more wolves meant healthier bears. Ravens, eagles, and other scavengers feasted too. Wolves chase off or kill coyotes, and fewer coyotes left more rabbits and voles for hawks, eagles, and foxes. Since the wolves returned, the park has seen more different species of wildlife thrive. The chain reaction started by the wolves' return has moved throughout Yellowstone. It's proof that an ecosystem needs all of its parts, even the predators. In the photograph, bears have more berries to eat when wolves chase off bush-munching elk. At the bottom of page 28, a summary. No wolves. With no wolves, elk and deer herds grew huge. They nibbled the park bare. Fewer trees and bushes meant fewer birds and beavers. Bare hillsides lost soil to wind and mudslides. Coyotes also multiplied with no wolves to chase them off. With wolves. When the wolves returned, they chased the elk and thinned the herds. They gave trees and grass time to regrow. With more trees, birds and beavers returned. Beaver dams made marshy areas that helped clean the rivers. They are also habitats for water birds and animals. Wolves chased off coyotes, leaving more small game for birds of prey. The leftovers from wolf kills also feed hungry bears, eagles, magpies, badgers, and foxes. Ask, Ask, with Sage and Briar. Text by Ellen R. Braff. Art by Marnie Galloway. Zoe C. in Georgia wants to know, how do bruises go away? Asks Briar. Sage responds, a bruise happens when you get bumped hard enough to break tiny blood vessels in muscles and skin, but the skin doesn't break. The hurt blood vessels leak blood under the skin, making a bruise. I banged my leg, but I don't see any bruise. At first, the hurt spot might just look pink, but over the next few days, it will turn a vivid bluish, purple color, then greenish, then yellow before fading away. I'm going to change color. The color changes happen as your immune system clears away the trapped blood and repairs the blood vessels. Special immune cells break down the spilled blood into smaller bits that have different colors. Like taking apart a Lego construction? A bit. Purple appears as red blood cells break apart and give up iron. Your body has several different types of immune cells, each with different jobs. Some of us repair damage and recycle bits of old cells, says the macrophage. First, we split hemoglobin into heme, which has the iron, and globin, a protein, said the monocyte. Then, we break down the heme into biliverdin, which is green. Then, into bilirubin, which is yellow. Finally, bilirubin gets picked up and sent to the liver, where it is cleaned out of your blood to be excreted. So, can you tell how old a bruise is by its color? Yes. Red and purple bruises are newer. Green and yellow ones are older. Light brown are almost gone, though one bruise can show many colors at once. Do you know what a really ancient bruise is called? No, what? A dinosaur. Ouch, said the dinosaur. In the illustration, we see that a red bruise is about 2 days old, and by the time it turns brown, it's 10 to 14 days. Ask us anything. Write to us at Ask, 1 East Erie Street, Suite 525, PMB 4136, Chicago, Illinois, 60611, or have your parent email ask@cricketmedia.com. That's it for the February edition of Ask Magazine. I'm Chris, Radio Volunteer, Ron Pariser.